Oliphant was overtaken by an abrupt nausea. At Fraser's Manor, at the proximity of the corpse, at the pervading stink of burnt beans. He turned and stepped out into the hallway, where another of Fraser's men was adjusting the carbide lantern. What a foul house this was, in a foul street, harbouring the foulest sort of business. A wave of loathing overtook him, a fierce, hopeless detestation of the secret world, its midnight journeys, labyrinthine lies, its legions of the damned, the lost. His hands were trembling as he struck a lucifer to light his cheroot. "Sir, the responsibility," Betteridge was at his elbow. "My friend at the corner of Chancery Lane hasn't given me such a good leaf as usual," Oliphant said, frowning at the tip of his cheroot. "One must be very careful how one chooses one's cigars."
"We've been over the place top to bottom, Mr. Oliphant. If she was living here, there's no trace of her."
"Really? And to whom does that handsome chiffonier downstairs belong? Who waters the cacti? Does one water cacti? Perhaps they reminded our Texian friend of his homeland." He puffed resolutely on his cheroot and descended the stairs, with Betteridge on his heels like an anxious young setter. A prim-looking sort from criminal anthropometry was lost in thought in front of the piano, as though trying to recall a tune. Of the various articles carried in this gentleman's black case, Oliphant knew, the least unpleasant were the calibrated linen tapes employed in taking Bertillon measurements of the skull.
"Sir," Betteridge said, when the anthropometrist had moved upstairs, "if you feel I was responsible, sir, for losing her, I mean,
I believe, Betteridge, that I dispatched you earlier to a matinee at the Garrick to report on the acrobatic ladies of Manhattan, did I not?"
"Yes, sir."
"You saw the Manhattan troupe, then?"
"Yes, sir."
"But do let me suppose, you saw her there as well?"
Yes, sir, and Mackerel and his two as well."
Oliphant removed his spectacles and polished them. "The acrobats, Betteridge? To attract such an audience, they must have been quite remarkable."
"No, sir, they batter one another with brickbats. The women run about in their dirty bare feet, and, well, scarves, sir, bits of gauze, no proper garments to speak of."
"And you enjoyed yourself, Betteridge?"
"Quite honestly, sir, no. Like a panto in Bedlam it was, and I'd the job of it with the Pinkers there."
Mackerel was their name for the senior Pinkerton agent, a side-whiskered Philadelphian who most frequently presented himself as Beaufort Kingsley de Haven, though sometimes as Beaumont Alexander Stokes. He was Mackerel by virtue of his seemingly invariable choice of breakfast, as reported by Betteridge and the other watchers. Mackerel and two subordinates had been regular London fixtures for some 18 months now, and Oliphant found them remarkably interesting and a solid pretext for his own government funding. The Pinkerton organization, while ostensibly a private firm, served as the central intelligence-gathering organ of the embattled United States. With networks in place throughout the Confederate States, as well as in the republics of Texas and California, the Pinkertons were often privy to information of considerable strategic importance. With the arrival in London of Mackerel and his cohorts, certain voices in Special Branch had argued for the various classic modes of coercion. Oliphant had quickly moved to quash this suggestion, arguing that the Americans would be of inestimably greater value if they were allowed to operate freely, under, he made it clear, the constant surveillance of both the Special Branch and his own Special Bureau of the Foreign Office. In practice, of course, the Special Bureau utterly lacked the manpower for any such undertaking, which had resulted in Special Branch assigning Betteridge to the task, along with a steady rota of nondescript Londoners, all of them experienced watchers personally vetted by Oliphant. Betteridge reported directly to Oliphant, who assessed the raw material before passing it on to Special Branch. Oliphant found the arrangement thoroughly agreeable. Special Branch had so far refrained from comment. The movements of the Pinkertons had gradually revealed minor but hitherto unsuspected substrata of clandestine activity. The resultant information constituted a rather mixed bag, but this was all the more to Oliphant's liking. The Pinkertons, he had happily declared to Betteridge, would provide the equivalent of geological core samples. The Pinkertons would plumb the depths, and Britain would reap the benefits. Betteridge, almost immediately, and to his considerable pride, had discovered that one Mr. Fuller, the Texian legation's sole and woefully overworked clerk, was in Pinkerton pay. In addition, Mackerel had demonstrated a profound curiosity about the affairs of General Sam Houston. going so far as to personally burglarise the country estate of the exiled Texian president. Some months subsequently, the Pinkertons had shadowed Michael Radley, Houston's flack, whose murder in Grant's Hotel had led directly to a number of Oliphant's current lines of inquiry.
"And you saw our Mrs. Bartlett attending the communard performance? You're entirely positive?"
"No question, sir."
"Mackerel and company were aware of her? She of them?"
"No, sir. They were watching the communard panto, hooting and cheering. Mrs. Bartlett crept backstage between acts. She kept well in the rear afterwards. Applauding, though."
Betteridge frowned.
"The Pinkertons made no attempt to follow Mrs. Bartlett?"
"No, sir."
"But you did?"
"Yes, sir. When the show was done, I left Boots and Becky Dean to ghost our chaps and set out to dog her alone."
"You are very foolish, Betteridge."
Oliphant's tone was exceptionally mild.
"You should rather have dispatched Boots and Becky. They're far more experienced, and a team is invariably more efficient than a single watcher. You might easily have lost her."
Betteridge winced.
"Or she might have killed you, Betteridge. She's a murderess, quite appallingly accomplished, known to conceal vitriol about her person.
Sir, I take full—"
"No, Betteridge, no. None of it. She'd already killed our Texian Goliath. Highly premeditated, no doubt. She was in a position to provide him food, aiding and abetting him, just as she and her friends did during that night of terror at Grand's Hotel. She'd bring him round his tinned beans, you see. He depended on her. He'd gone to ground in a garret. Simply a matter of doctoring a tin."
"But why should she turn on him now, sir?"
"A question of loyalties, Betteridge. Our Texian was a nationalist zealot. Patriots may league with the very devil in pursuit of a nation's interest, but there are matters at which they balk. Likely she demanded some deadly service from him, and he refused."
He knew as much from the confession of Collins. The nameless Texian had been a fractious ally.
"The fellow crossed her, spurned her schemes, as did the late Professor Rudwick. So he met the same fate as the man he killed."
"She must be desperate."
"Perhaps. But we have no reason to believe you alerted her by following her here."
Betteridge blinked.
"Sir, when you sent me to see the communards, did you suspect she might be there?"
"Not at all. I confess, Betteridge, I was indulging a whim. Lord Engles, an acquaintance of mine, is fascinated by this fellow Marx, the commune's founder."
"Engles, the textile magnate?"
"Yes. He's quite eccentric about it, actually."
"About those communard women, sir?"
"About Mr. Marx's theories in general, and the fate of the Manhattan Commune in particular. Friedrich's generosity, in fact, made this current tour possible."
"The richest man in Manchester, funding that sort of tribe?"
Betteridge seemed genuinely disturbed by the revelation.
"Peculiar, yes. Friedrich is himself the son of a wealthy Rhineland industrialist. In any case, I was curious for your report. And, of course, I did rather expect our Mr. Mackerel to put in an appearance. The United States take the dimmest possible view of the Red Revolution in Manhattan."
"One of the women gave a sort of, well, sermon, sir, before the panto, and ranted like 60.
Some business about iron laws."
"The iron law of history, yes. All very doctrinaire. But Marx has borrowed much of his theory from Lord Babbage, so much so that his doctrine may one day dominate America."
Oliphant's nausea had passed.
"But consider, Betteridge, that the Commune was founded during city-wide anti-war riots protesting the Union conscription. Marx and his followers seized power during a period of chaos, somewhat akin to last summer's affliction in London. Here, of course, we've come through in good form, and that in spite of having lost our great orator in the very midst of the emergency. Proper succession of power is everything, Betteridge?"
"Yes, sir."
Betteridge nodded, distracted from the matter of Lord Engle's communard sympathies by Oliphant's patriotic sentiments. Oliphant, suppressing a sigh, rather wished that he himself believed them. Oliphant nodded and napped on the journey home. He dreamed, as he often did, of an omniscient eye in whose infinite perspectives might be sorted every least mystery. Upon arrival, he found, to his ill-concealed chagrin, that Bligh had drawn a bath for him in the collapsible rubber tub recently prescribed by Dr. McNeil. In robe and nightshirt, slippered in embroidered moleskin, Oliphant examined the thing with resigned distaste. It stood steaming before the perfectly good and perfectly empty tub of white porcelain which dominated his bathroom. It was Swiss, the rubber bath, its slack black trough gone taut and bulbous with the volume of water it presently contained. Supported by an elaborately hinged frame of black enameled teak, it was connected to the geyser with a warm-like hose and several ceramic petcocks. Removing his robe and then his nightshirt, he stepped from his slippers, then from the chill of octagonal marble tiles into the soft, warm moor. It very nearly overturned as he struggled to sit. The elastic material, supported on all sides by the frame, gave distressingly beneath one's feet, and was, he discovered, quite horrid in its embrace of one's buttocks. He was, according to McNeil's prescription, to recline for a quarter hour, his head supported on the small pneumatic pillow of rubberized canvas supplied for this purpose by the manufacturer. McNeil maintained that the cast-iron body of a porcelain tub confused the spine's natural attempts to return to its correct magnetic polarity. Oliphant shifted slightly, grimacing at the obscene sensation of the clinging rubber. Bligh had arranged a sponge, pumice, and a fresh bar of French-milled soap in the little bamboo basket attached to the side of the tub. Bamboo, Oliphant supposed, must also lack magnetic properties. He groaned, then took up the sponge and soap and began to wash himself. Released from the pressing business of the day, Oliphant, as he often did, undertook a detailed and systematic act of recollection. He had a natural gift for memory, greatly aided in youth by the educational doctrines of his father, whose ardent interest in mesmerism and the tricks of stage magic had introduced his son to the arcane disciplines of mnemonics. Such accomplishments had been of great use to Oliphant in later life, and he practiced them now with a regularity he had once devoted to prayer. Almost a year had passed since his search through the effects of Michael Radley in Room 37, Grand's Hotel. Radley had owned a modern steamer trunk of the sort that, upended and opened, served as a compact combination of wardrobe and bureau. This, along with a scuffed leather hatcase and a brass-framed Jacquard satchel, constituted the whole of the publicist's luggage. Oliphant had found the intricacy of the trunk's fittings depressing. All these hinges, runners, hooks, nickeled catches and leather tabs, they spoke of a dead man's anticipation of journeys that were never to be. Equally pathetic were the three gross of fancily stippled carte de visite, with Radley's Manchester Telegraph number arranged in the French manner, still wrapped in printer's tissue. He began by unpacking each section in turn, laying Radley's clothing out on the hotel bed with a valet's precision. The publicist had entertained a fondness for silk nightshirts. As he worked, Oliphant examined maker's labels and laundry marks, turning out pockets and running his fingers over seams and linens. Radley's toilet articles were secured in a removable envelope of waterproofed silk. Oliphant examined the contents, handling each object in turn, a badger shaving brush, a self-stropping safety razor, a toothbrush, a tin of tooth powder, a sponge bag. He wrapped the ivory handle of the brush against the foot of the bedstead. He opened the razor's leatherette case. Nickel plate gleamed against a bed of violet velour. He emptied the tooth powder out on a sheet of Grand's engraved stationery. He looked in the sponge bag and found a sponge. The glitter of the razor drew his eye. Dumping its various components atop the starched bib of an evening shirt, he used the penknife on his watch chain to pry the fitted velour nest from the case. It came away easily, revealing a tightly folded sheet of foolscap. Upon this sheet, in pencil, quite smudged with frequent erasure and re-erasure, was written what appeared to be the start of a draft letter. Undated, lacking any term of address, it was unsigned. "I trust you recall our two conversations of the past aug, during second of which you so kindly entrusted me with your conjectures. I am pleased to inform you that certain manipulations have yielded a version, a true version of your origin, which I feel most confidently can at last be run, thereby demonstrating that proof so long sought and expected." The remainder of the sheet was blank, with the exception of three faintly pencilled rectangles containing the Roman capitals ALG, COMP, and MOD. ALG, COMP, and MOD had subsequently become a fabulous three-headed beast, frequent visitor to the higher fields of Oliphant's imagination. His discovery of the probable meaning of this cipher, while examining transcripts of the interrogation of William Collins, had failed to dispel the image. Algecomp Mod was with him still, a serpent-necked chimera, its heads nastily human. Radley's face was there, quite dead, mouth agape, eyes blank as fog, and the cool marble features of Lady Ada Byron, aloof and impassive, framed by curls and ringlets that were proofs of a pure geometry. But the third head, sinuously swaying, evaded Oliphant's gaze. He sometimes imagined its face was Edward Mallory's, resolutely ambitious, hopelessly frank. At other times he took it to be the pretty, poisonous visage of Florence Bartlett, wreathed in fumes of vitriol. And sometimes, particularly as now, in the rubber bath's cloying embrace, drifting toward the continent of sleep, the face was his own, its eyes filled with a dread he could not name. The following morning Oliphant slept in, then kept to his bed, Bligh supplying him with files from the study, strong tea, and anchovy toast. He read a Foreign Office dossier on one Wilhelm Stieber, a Prussian agent posing as an émigré newspaper editor named Schmidt. With considerably more interest, he read and annotated a Bow Street file detailing several recent attempts to smuggle munitions, each incident involving cargo destined for Manhattan. The next file consisted of engine-printed copies of several letters from a Mr. Copeland of Boston. Mr. Copeland, who travelled in lumber, was in British pay. His letters described the system of forts defending the island of Manhattan, with extensive notes on ordnance. Oliphant's gaze, from long practice, slid lightly over Copeland's account of the South Battery on Governor's Island, something of a relic by the sound of it, and quickly arrived at a report of rumours that the Commune had strung a chain of mines from the Roma Shoals to the Narrows. Oliphant sighed. He very much doubted that the channel had been mined, but the leaders of the Commune would certainly wish it to be thought to have been mined, as indeed it might soon be, if the gentlemen of the Commission for Free Trade were to have their way. Bligh was at the door.
"You've an appointment with Mr. Wakefield, sir, at the Central Statistics Bureau."
An hour later Betteridge greeted him from the open door of a cab.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Oliphant."
Oliphant climbed in and settled himself. Pleated shades of black-proofed canvas were drawn firmly across either window, shutting out Half Moon Street and the stark November sun. As the driver urged the cab horse forward, Betteridge opened a case at his feet, took out a lamp, which he lit in a rapid and dexterous fashion, and fixed, with a brass apparatus of screws and bolts, to the arm of the seat. The interior of the case glittered like a miniature arsenal. He passed Oliphant a crimson file folder. Oliphant opened the file, which detailed the circumstances of the death of Michael Radley. He had himself been in the smoking room with the general and poor, doomed Radley, the both of them awash with drink. Of their respective styles of drunkenness, Radley's had been the more presentable, the least predictable, the more dangerous. Houston, in his cups, delighted in playing the barbarous American, red-eyed, perspiring, foul-mouthed. He lounged with one great, coarse boot propped muddily atop an ottoman. As Houston spoke and smoked and spat, roundly cursing Oliphant and Britain, he sullenly shaved curls from a bit of pine, periodically pausing to strop the jackknife on the edge of his boot-sole. Radley, in contrast, had positively quivered with the liquor's stimulant effect, cheeks flushed and eyes flashing. Oliphant's visit had been intended deliberately to disturb Houston on the eve of his departure to France, but the display of ill-concealed mutual hostility evident between the general and his publicist had been quite unexpected. He had hoped to sow seeds of doubt with regard to the French tour. To this end, and primarily for Radley's benefit, he had managed to imply an exaggerated degree of cooperation on the parts of the intelligence services of Britain and France. Oliphant had suggested that Houston already possessed at least one powerful enemy among the police de Chateau, the bodyguard and secret personal agency of the Emperor Napoleon. While the police de Chateau were few in number, Oliphant insinuated, they were utterly without legal or constitutional restraint. Radley, at least, in spite of his condition, had obviously taken note of the implied threat. They had been interrupted by a page, who brought a note for Radley. As the door opened to admit the man, Oliphant had glimpsed the anxious face of a young woman. Radley had stated, as he excused himself, that it was necessary that he speak briefly with a journalistic contact. Radley had returned to the smoking room some 10 minutes later. Oliphant then took his leave, having endured an extended and particularly florid tirade from the general, who had consumed the better part of a pint of brandy during Radley's absence. Summoned back to Grand's by telegram in the early hours of dawn, Oliphant had immediately sought out the hotel detective, a retired metropolitan named McQueen, who had been called to Houston's room number 24 by the desk clerk, Mr. Parks. While Parks attempted to calm the hysterical wife of a Lancashire paving contractor, resident in number 25 at the time of the disturbance, McQueen had tried the knob of Houston's door, discovering it to be unlocked. Snow was blowing in through the demolished window, and the air, already chilled, stank of burnt gunpowder, blood, and, as McQueen delicately put it, the contents of the late gentleman's bowel. Spying the scarlet ruin that was Radley's corpse, all too visible in the cold light of dawn, McQueen had called to Parks to telegraph the Metropolitans. He then used his passkey to lock the door, lit a lamp, and blocked the view from the street with the remains of one of the window curtains. The condition of Radley's clothing indicated that the pockets had been gone through. Sundry personal objects lay in the pool of blood and other matter surrounding the corpse, a repeating match, a cigar case, coins of various denominations. Lamp in hand, the detective surveyed the room, discovering an ivory-handled Leacock and Hutchings pocket pistol. The weapon's trigger was missing. Three of its five barrels had been discharged. Very recently, McQueen judged. Continuing his search, he had discovered the gaudy, gilded head of General Houston's stick, awash in splintered glass. Nearby lay a bloodied packet, tightly wrapped in brown paper. It proved to contain 100 kinetrope cards, their intricate fretting of punch holes ruined by the passage of a pair of bullets. The bullets themselves, of soft lead and much distorted, fell into McQueen's palm as he examined the cards. Subsequent examination of the room by specialists from Central Statistics, the attention of the Metropolitan Police at Oliphant's request having been swiftly deflected from the matter, added little to what the veteran McQueen had observed. The trigger of the Leacock and Hutchings pepper box was recovered from beneath an armchair. A more peculiar discovery consisted of a square-cut white diamond of 15 carats and very high quality, which was found firmly wedged between two floorboards. Two men from criminal anthropometry, no more than usually cryptic about their purposes, employed large squares of tissue-thin adhesive grid paper to capture various hairs and bits of fluff from the carpet. They guarded these specimens jealously and took them away promptly, and nothing was ever heard of them again.